Hey guys, welcome to the MC Anime Podcast.
We cover anime, geek culture, Japanese aesthetics, and Asian studies. We are a multi-fandom podcast, and you can expect to hear topics in your favorite hobby or fandom activity potentially. You can find MC Anime on Google Podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. Also, please check out mcanimepodcast.com, our website. Furthermore, stay tuned in for another episode.
Hey guys, this is MC from NC Anime Podcast. We're back with another guest today, Dan Nessel. How are you doing today?
Hey Mason, it's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me along. I think this is going to be a lot of fun.
Yep, good. Tell the audience a little about yourself, what you do, and where they can find you.
Sure. Dan Nessel, as you have said, I am a PR communications marketing consultant. I run a company called Inquisitive Communications. You can find me at b-inquisitive.com or on LinkedIn. I'm pretty much an open book on LinkedIn. Just look for Dan Nessel, N-E-S-T-L-E, like the chocolate, but no relation. And you can find me on most of the socials at D-S Nessel, S as in Steven, D-S-N-E-S-T-L-E.
All right. So for today's topic is going to be Living in Japan 101. Dan was able to live in Japan for 10 plus years. And has a lot of experience in Japan, so he thought it'd be worthy to bring it on, share what he has to do, and we can also dive into a little who's action too. So, what is like living in Japan?
That's a great, big, giant question, Mason. So I lived there for 16 years, and I went there originally just out of college to teach English, and ended up I was only going to go for a year. I ended up being there for 16. I lived way in the countryside for the first 3 years. So, you know, I know that fans of your show, our listeners, are really, you know, anime fans. So if you think about, you know, all of the great work coming out of, Studio Ghibli, you know, those Miyazaki films are mostly like based when you see those beautiful forests and you see like the protection of nature. Think about that as my backyard. That's where I lived the first 3 years. These gorgeous, like beautiful rolling green hills and rivers and, you know, mostly untouched area. And then after 3 years, I went to the big city of Tokyo and, you know, that's where you see the other side of anime and of Japanese culture. Very cyber heavy, very tech heavy. So I got both sides of what is, I think of what you would consider a Japan experience. And living there was, the first couple of years was really in a rural setting. I was teaching at these junior high schools in these fishing villages. Great, great time for a 21-year-old, you know, I studied Japanese in college, you know, so I had a little bit of understanding of the language, but nobody around me spoke English much.
So there's a couple English as a second language.
I was teaching English as English as a foreign language there. In junior high schools, and teaching is kind of a strong term. It was more like being a fun, young, cultural kind of American, right? To I guess create great relationships and help Japan internationalize in some very, very, very small way. And my students were not, you know, they had no intention of really being English speakers, but they were just wonderful, wonderful people. And you know, I would never trade it for a moment of anything else. It's a lot of fun.
Will fully take you in as the diplomacy conservative nature?
Yeah, you know, I don't think so. I mean, people will say that you can really, you know, become part of Japan, part of Japanese culture. Look, I speak Japanese. I lived there for so long. I had lots of Japanese friends. I did all of the really cool, like kind of Japanese cultural things that you do. But I think in the long term, I had a much better time once I realized that I would always be a guest, right? So to some extent, yes, they did take me in that everybody was loving, friendly, warm, and true friendships and real relationships. But there's always this, you know, this sense, well, you know, a Japanese person would do X. You know, the Japanese always say, you know, always say like, Nihonjin takara, like as a Japanese person, because I'm Japanese, right? When they talk about things. So they automatically kind of set up this dynamic where, you know, you're an outsider. But if you can embrace that and understand, okay, I'm an outsider, I'm a guest, well, that doesn't change the fact that I owe it to my hosts to dive into the culture, to understand their language, to really embrace them, and then they'll embrace me back. And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, eventually over time, I certainly was accepted a lot more, but, you know, I never fooled myself to think I'm one of the Japanese now, you know, and I think that was helpful in my journey. Yeah.
What socialist society that they have, pretty much, if you not have the conformity in the traditional nature of what they look like, skin and the hair color,
yeah,
then pretty much you stand out.
Okay.
So standing out in that type of culture is what they try to avoid. But you can't help by standing out in this, well, you're not in Japan. So being non-Japanese kind of gives this like, well, I don't mind being a guest, but there is ways to minimize the effects of that
process. Yeah. Also, I mean, it is a little different now. Remember, I landed in Japan in 1993, okay? So that was a long time ago. And so the 16 years was until 2009-ish. And I've been back a lot since then. So like, I still stay connected to Japan. And in fact, my older daughter is studying, she's now a college student in Tokyo. So like, you know, and I married a Japanese woman. So like, you know, I go to see my in-laws every so often. I'm still very, very connected to the world and to the culture. But yeah, standing out, you can't help it, right? If you don't look like a local. And where I lived, I could tell you when I landed in 1993, there were 6 non-Japanese people within like 10 square miles. So, and we knew each other, we were all friends, we did things together. And eventually, you know, you kind of think, well, you know, there's some advantages to standing out a little bit. You know, people recognize you, but there's pressure too, because, you know, that means that, like it or not, you're sort of representing that other. And, you know, if you give a bad impression or if you live up to some of the stereotypes that they think about, then you're doing damage to all future non-Japanese people who go there. And that was kind of, I didn't really think about it too much at the time, but, you know, looking in retrospect, standing out had its drawbacks, you know, but at the same time, it was really great. I mean, you know, I would be riding down the street on, I had like a scooter, you know, like a, not a Vespa, but something like that. I think it was a Suzuki, but I'd be riding down the street, you know, and then 2 days later, I'd be, you know, 15 miles away at one of my little schools, because I taught at these little, you know, fishing villages, these little schools. Some of the schools had like, you know, they're junior high schools, which is 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. And the smallest school was really remote. And there was like, I think, a total of 20 students for all 3 years. Like, it was really tiny. So I'd go out there to the school a couple of days later and somebody would say to me, oh, I heard you were riding around town with no helmet. You know, like you're like miles away. And you're, you know, so it hits you hard that everything that you do is sort of people notice and they, you know, they'll tell others. Now, of course, later, I mean, it's still like that a lot in rural Japan. Tokyo is a completely different kettle of fish. There's plenty of, it's a very international feeling city, although, you know, it's like, you know, 90-something% you know, Japanese locals, but they're now, you know, totally accustomed to interacting with non-Japanese. So you don't stand out as much there. It's just, okay, you're just another guy going to work, you know.
So you have the city center and you have the country center. What was, you think was better?
I think they were both equally fantastic. For long-term, I think my own psychological health, the city was better because I had a social, like a much bigger social circle. And I was, you know, by the time I moved to Tokyo, you know, I was in the business world. I was working at these, you know, for companies and going all over the place. And, you know, and then I, you know, when you start, as you start to like go on your career, you get a little bit more money. And then, you know, you're like, okay, I want to go out to different bars and I want to go meet different, you know, different women, et cetera. City's better for that, for sure. And then, you know, as I married and settled down, you know, living in the city there was just so much to do, and there's places to take your kids, and there's things to do. Like, you know, there's never a boring day. There's never a question, especially Tokyo, which has, I would argue, the best food scene in the world. You never have to worry about like, okay, what are we going to eat tonight? Or is there a place to eat? Or, you know, what kind of food do you feel like? The transportation is fantastic. It's totally safe and clean and great place to be for a while. But, you know, you eventually, after we had our second daughter, I have two kids. And after we had the second one, it just got too tight. You know, like you get to a point where, okay, I need space. And some people don't. Some people like the small, you know, stay with kind of a tight environment. You know, me and my wife, we were just like, you know, we need to stretch a little bit more. So we came back to the States. But yeah, I mean, I love the city. At the same time, my wife is she's from the countryside as well. So her family is very rural Japan, but near Mount Fuji. And I always got my kind of dose. You know, I'd have my city time, and then we'd go to my in-laws, and it would be like living out in the country again. Same kind of feel, local village, you know, no other foreigners or non-Japanese around, you know, standing out again in her family's world. And so I always got kind of both sides of the coin. I found that the people of the countryside are wonderful, and you know, the kind of, you know, relationships that you can build in the countryside are probably more lasting, I think, you know, if you give it time. But it's just really a lifestyle choice at some point. You know, we didn't really raise our kids there, so like we left when my kids were under 5 years old, so we didn't experience the school system or anything like that, so I couldn't tell you which would be better from that perspective. But from a living perspective, man, I mean, it's really, you know, if you like to fish and you like to kind of, you know, go hiking and you're like a huge nature person, the countryside clearly is your place to be, right? But even then, in Tokyo, everything's a train ride away, so you could go any place you want to within a day, anywhere in Japan almost, and enjoy all of what Japan has to offer.
So you bring up the in-laws and marriage. What were some of the customs of the marriage itself that was interesting or took you back?
That whole experience was a, you know, you have these moments in your life that shape you and that change you. My whole experience living in the countryside for the first 3 years didn't really prepare me that much for my father-in-law and my mother-in-law. You know, regions in Japan, different regions have very different characters, you know? And I came from a small fishing village on the coast where it was really kind of laid back. And then my wife's family are farmers in the mountains. So they're definitely a kind of more like a stricter, more kind of even more traditional, disciplined type of a family. So, you know, the kind of, I think the kind of relaxed atmosphere I enjoyed in the countryside didn't really fly very well with my father-in-law when I first met him, you know. Also, you know, to their credit, they ultimately did accept me, and certainly, you know, they've been a fantastic family. I mean, her family's wonderful, but they were, you know, they've been great to my kids. You know, my daughter who's in Japan now goes and sees her grandparents pretty often. So like they're amazing that way. But at first, they really did not like the idea of a non-Japanese person entering their family. And it took me a little while, and took my wife a little while to convince them, or to just sort of wait until they came around. You know, I had to go. This is the big thing. What the big kind of moment? You know, it was New Year's before we got married. It was about almost a year before we got married. New Year's day. And New Year's is like, in Japan, is a more solemn, more kind of serious occasion. It's not like a party day necessarily. It's a family time. It's a time where you've cleaned out your house of all the crap from the past year and all of the bad spirits, and you start the year afresh, but you're kind of in the family mode, and it's relatively calm. So she took me there on New Year's Day, and that was a big deal because it's like a family day. And I was escorted into the guest kind of, we might call it a parlor, but there's a guest room with tatami mats and the low table. And, there's pictures of the emperor on the wall. And I see like the shrine, there's a family shrine up on the right. And there's the family, Butsudan. It's a, like the Buddhist, the most traditional Japanese families have two, they represent two religions, I suppose you could say, in their house. They have the Shinto shrine and they have the Buddhist kind of altar, let's call it, to the ancestors. So I'm sitting in front of the Buddhist thing, with the incense burning. There's the Shinto shrine, little mini shrine up there. A picture of the emperor looking down at me. It's like, it was like designed to make me feel out of place, or intimidated in some ways. And my future father-in-law at that time sits down in front of me. He doesn't really waste much time. He says, look, I don't know why you're here. You're not going to really ever be accepted by our family. We just don't think that you can contribute, I think is the best translation, to what we're doing. This is all in Japanese, by the way. So, I think I got about 85% of what he was saying. And, he basically said that around these parts, we have an allergy to foreigners. And that's exactly what he said. And that's 100% accurate. We have an allergy to foreigners. So it was a great way to kick off a relationship with him. He said, and then he started to dig into why. And he said that, well, you have no history and you have no sense of culture. You have, I don't know you, Dan, but I don't think you know anything about farming. And I don't think, and he just went down this laundry list of all the things that I couldn't do. And then I started speaking to him and I said, look, you're right about the farming. I can't do that. But I could learn, because I can learn anything. But apart from that, if you're saying that I have no history or culture, you're right. My country is younger than the stones that are in the front of, that he's used to make the front kind of steps of his house. He's got, his house is there, has been there for 700 years. It's been rebuilt a billion times, but it's still in the same place. There's a little graveyard in the back with his ancestors from 1,000 years ago. So I said to him, well, you're right. Like, my country's only 250 years old, but I belong to a culture because I'm Jewish, and I belong to this culture that goes back 6,000 years, and I can trace it to one guy. And I feel like I have a pretty good sense of history. And he was kind of impressed by that. Sort of, I could sense a change in his tone. And he's like, well, okay, maybe that's the case, but I don't think that you could really get along with our family. And I said, well, I'm speaking to you in Japanese. I could speak to your sons and your wife. I'm a generally likable person. And anyway, it went on like that for a while. Then he left the room. He left the room I think he was trying to just scare me away. And then his wife comes in. It was hysterical. His wife comes in and she's like, takes the completely opposite side. Because she's like, look, I know that you can be, you're a nice guy, damn, my daughter loves you, et cetera. But, frankly, we're just afraid that you're going to take her away, And I said, well, it's not really up to me, is it? Right. It's up to her. And my mother-in-law was like, okay, I'll do what I can, to plead your case. And then for the rest of the day, we sat around and we ate food. 2 weeks later, my wife gets a call, says, all right, we need you to come back, but without him. So she goes back. Now we're like, it's around early, like late January. So, she goes back to the compound. I call it the compound. It's a big farming house. She goes back to compound and she comes back that night and she goes, well, they've decided to accept you. It was like a 2 week period. They've decided to accept you. So next week we have to go back. So we went back the following week. And then when I went back, it was a completely different thing. You know, the first time they ushered me into that, you know, to that scary guest room with the tatami mats, this time I went to the other side of the house, which is the inner sanctum, where it's like normal life. There's a couple of sofas. There's a kotatsu, which is a small low-level table that has a heating element underneath. There's a cold in the winter. And they're like, Dan, come sit down. Stretch out your legs under the kotatsu. And they start serving me tea. And there's like laundry hanging up on the wall. And like, in other words, they were just showing me now that if I'm accepted, then they literally get to air out their dirty laundry. Like there was like no secrets anymore, or like, let's not even bother to show this outer face. And I'm not saying it was dirty or anything like that. It's a beautiful home, but you know, it had the clutter of life. And you know, I went to the kitchen with her mom. Like, it was a completely different situation. So, you know, then I think I washed dishes that night, and they were just like, "What the hell are you doing? He washes dishes. I've been married for 30 years and nobody's washed dishes in this house." So it was a very different experience from that point forward. And then, yeah, I mean, and then, you know, my father-in-law gradually warmed up, and, you know, he's not the most conversational guy, but, you know, he does offer these pearls of wisdom every so often. You know, some of them are good and some of them aren't, but they're very traditional people. And I get along with her brothers super well, and her brothers, she has two younger brothers. They're fantastic, big families. There's now loads of cousins. My daughters love it. So it sort of went in the right direction, ultimately, you know. I don't know where we were going with this, but I think the marriage itself, the wedding, I think you asked about, was really super traditional. I wore the men's version of the kimono. You know, I had to go to the wedding venue, you know, like 6 hours before the wedding, so that these four women could just like go, like, tighten me up and dress me, you know. Like pulling on they're like, "Oh, you know, you're not shaped really well for this, but we're gonna make it work." And I'm not like a big guy, but I'm big by their standards. You know, I'm just like, you know, I'm just like a normal, you know, average sized person. But it's hysterical.
Typically small. So you being with different gene pool, being a little bit tall and a little bit wider, a little bit broader, be a little bit of a challenge.
Yeah, it was fun, but it was honey. And then, you know,
structure and face structure. So then you have a different gene pool. So that's kind of,
I mean, they tightened me up in this thing really nice. You know, and then we had the wedding at a Japanese weddings will mostly take place at these, wedding venues. And it's like, they're almost like wedding factories. You go into this, it looks like a hotel, but it's not. There's like maybe 10 or 15 weddings going on at the same time, you know, so it's all well choreographed. All right, here's what you got to do. You got to get up. Okay, we're going to take you to this room. You're going to get this little piece of paper. You're going to turn it around 3 times. You're going to shake the stick, and then you're going to drink the tea. And then like these little rituals. And I'm like, there was no rehearsal. What's going on? So my wife's like, it's going to be okay. Don't worry. And she's wearing a wig that weighs like, I think it was 4.5 or 5 pounds. Like,
yeah.
So, you know, it was beautiful though. And then we had this big party. There's 7 or 8 weddings going on at the same time at the venue. A very famous tennis player at the time was getting married there that day. I forget her name. But there was like lots of very nice cars in the parking lot, you know, that kind of thing. So it's a great experience. And it was just like they do everything they can to make it as unique to you as you possibly can. And, you know, they like, I like a particular type of beer from Japan. I like Kirin beer has always been one of my favorites. But there's in Japan they do these seasonal beers, right?
Yeah.
And my favorite was this one called Akiyaji, the flavor of autumn, right? But we were getting married in November, so the flavor of autumn was released in August and September, and they were like, "Oh, I don't know if we're gonna have any left for November. I mean, it's gonna be hard. Oh, you know, it's a very, very difficult request." But we got a call like 3 days before the wedding. It's like, we were able to secure 25 cases or pallets or whatever it is of Akiyaji for you. You know, so they really go out of their way. It was fantastic. Anybody who is going to live in Japan, I'm not saying go ahead and get married in Japan for the experience, but you know, if you get a chance to go to a Japanese wedding, it's a trip.
Yeah, my mom did with a friend Oko. She was like, she was an exchange student, and she went to Japan for about some time, and they got some her family, and she went to the States, vice versa, so they switched living situations, and that's how she was able to go to that wedding.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting to see how one can be taken in, but also accepting the smaller
the stuff that you might not know about, the stuff that just sort of happened associated.
Did you take in any of the ancestral honoree aspect of Shinto? Because Shinto is very ancestral celebration, honoring those who passed away, remembering the memory, all that stuff.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that. Buddhism is all about the dead. It's all about the ancestors, right? For Japan and the Japanese. So when people say, what are the Japanese religion? They really, it's not that they have a religion, not like in the sense of they go to church or they go to temple or synagogue or mosque or whatever. Their daily life every day is infused with both Buddhism and Shinto. And, you know, they don't really think about it except on festival days and on life events. So Buddhism is for funerals, for worshiping the ancestors, for honoring the ancestors. Shinto is for life. Shinto is birth, marriage, naming, you know, harvest, all these things. So, I mean, that's the easiest way to split it. And yeah, I got really into, I mean, I would take every opportunity to participate in anything. You know, the Buddhist stuff, of course, because it's all about death and you try to avoid that. I don't want to go to funerals. But the big festival, the big summer festivals all across Japan they're called Obon. And that's fundamentally, you know, a Buddhist based festival where, you know, you welcome your ancestors back to earth for a few days. And it's a celebratory, there's festivals everywhere. There's fireworks everywhere. It is a blast. And, you know, you go to the cemetery and you clean up the graves, you know, so that's part of what we did. And then, of course, my wedding was Shinto. I've been to dozens and dozens of shrines. And when I lived in the countryside, I was really privileged to take part in there. So the whole, if you want to call it holiest, I don't know if you'd say that, but the holiest or most important shrine, a Shinto shrine in Japan, is called the Ise Grand Shrine. And that's where the sun goddess, Amaterasu, she is, that's like basically her house, right? And each of the grand shrines, as they are, there's a few of them, are all centered around some sort of artifact. And the artifact in the grand shrine of Ise is a mirror. Like, you know, of course, nobody's ever allowed to look at the mirror because it was her mirror. It was Amaterasu's mirror, right? So this shrine is in Ise, and every 20 years, they knock it down and rebuild it, right? Because it's built with no metal except the gold leaf, and that's kind of on top that they decorate it with. But there's no metal involved. It's all wood. It's all beautiful cedar wood. So over time, you know, it decays. So they rebuild it every 20 years. And the rebuilding festival is the only time that that people outside of the royal family, let's say, are able to enter the shrine past a certain point. There's like different gates, right? So I was there during the rebuilding festival. So I was able to go in all the way in to the shrine because by that point they had moved the mirror to the new shrine. Right, so they build the new shrine next to the old shrine. They move the mirror over, and then they have these festivals where people go in and you know, you basically take down the old shrine and you help build the new one. You know, so I think our job that day was to bring rocks from the river. The ground around the shrine has to be covered with almost perfectly round white rocks that come from the river nearby. So they load up these rocks on these giant, like, ox carts almost. And then the townspeople, this is the festival, the townspeople then pull the carts through town, drinking, singing, you know, getting into these little violent things every now and then. Japanese festivals can be nuts. And then you pull these things to the shrine, and then they give you a looks like a handkerchief almost, because you're not supposed to actually touch the rock with your hand. put the rock in a handkerchief and then you drop the rock on the ground and you're done. You know, it's this hundreds and hundreds of people doing this, and that's how they do it. It was amazing, you know, so I was able to do that. So, I've been to some temples and what I guess are monasteries in the hills of Nara and Wakayama. And, you know, going back to Miyazaki, you know, if you look at, that's where he kind of bases all of his imagery, is from these places. So you're going around and thinking, you know, gosh, these places are there's this statue there that's, you know, 3,000 years old or 2,000, sorry, not 3,000, but like 2,000 years old. And, you know, it's awe-inspiring and certainly, you know, spiritual in a lot of ways.
Because with me, I've done Shinto as a topic, but I also did Buddhism. And the person I had was a Buddhist priestess. We're doing the spirituality of it. And Shinto, we're doing Japan and Shintoism. So It was interesting tracing back Shinto and the different, because also in Shinto there is little mini shrine family that are based on the Buddhist tradition, and they also did the same thing. But the core of my like culture, for me, necessarily, because I have no necessary establishment of culture, I trace it back to my faith. So Christianity is what I believe. Monolistic, one God, that type of stuff. And I use that spiritual discipline as my foundation. That's how I live my life. I live it to glory to Him, to glory to the Lord I have, Lord and Savior. And the way I approach it is like, well, if I embody the characteristics that He tells me to put forth, then I can embody it in a way to be central to me and have my culture. And of course, I would partake into Spanish culture a little bit as like a honoring, and then dive into Japanese and Asian as well. But really my foundation is what is faith-bounded in me. And that's really important because it gives a structure, the foundation, and it gives a path forward. Cool. And there is like some sects of Christianity in Japan that has been in that history, because what I did from Japan from then to now, there was a movement of Christianity, even small, but it was a minority religion. But the reason why we take forth in Japan was mostly the fact that Japan really wants to do ancestral, but also mini gods. So polytheistic and all based in nature deities. So it went against it. It went against their teaching. Shinto, which is the older version of the main religion, Buddhism, pretty much embody a different feel. Like Buddhism can be a culture. It doesn't have to be a religion. It can be the culture around it. Shinto can also be daily life and culture. And it's using more of the cultural aspect with both of those being combined. So it's interesting to see the dynamic of the different types of religion that took hold in Japan throughout this history. And when you see that people try to, you know, like the Jesuits and different society tried to bring forth other religion, only one that really stuck was Buddha. Shinto was, you know, older religion that Japan had for centuries. So Buddha was easy to adopt because, well, I mean, it still, let's just be honest, it's a Asian-based religion that doesn't punish you for believing in many gods or deities. And you can adapt it into your daily life and be full, you know, Shinto Buddhist or just Buddhist or just have it in your culture. And that's why when Japan assimilates different ideas, even Western ideas, they take it in and pretty much adapt their own version. They assimilate it into what their culture is and find what works when it really doesn't work. So basically, if you give them a Western idea, they're going to take that and put their spin on it, because that's how they do it. It's just how that happens. It's just their process is tied to national identity. If it's tied, if it can be tied with our history, tied with our customs, then that's what we do.
Yeah, it's pretty accurate. They did that with the major, you know, religions that came through. you know, Shinto was just, I think you're right, like it was just part of their culture. If you ask Japanese, do they believe in these gods? They believe is a strong word. You know, it's just part of them. You know, they, like my family will put out the, you know, they'll go to the local shrine around the corner, you know, around on New Year's and, you know, give their offerings, which is usually a couple of coins or something like that. And they'll put out little bits of food. And there's traditional things like a mandarin orange and little like mochi rice cake in the Shinto shrine in their house. And, you know, to get the favor of the harvest gods and so on. But they couldn't. I don't think they would really be able to name who those gods are. You know what I mean? Like, it's just something they do. No. Buddhism is a little bit more prayer focused, you know, because it's about the ancestors. But none of them, like, they, unless you're a monk or you're devoted to the study of Buddhism, you know, you'd be hard pressed to find somebody in Japan who's like religious. They're not wearing symbols. They're not like going to anything. It's just embedded because they've adapted it. You know, Buddhism came in the 6th or 7th century, I forget what it was, or 8th century. And it was imported from China, through China, as you said, like an Asian religion. And it really suited the way that they wanted to build the culture, you know? Like you said, like they're like, okay, you know, you start to get Confucianism and all this other stuff happening at the same time. And when you're in a feudal system with warlords at the top, you know, Buddhism really helps. Because I think it helps people to understand that life is just ephemeral. Things happen. You have your place, and if you're upset about something, it's your own fault. You know, I'm really, really not doing a good job with Buddhism here, but you know, the essence of suffering is selfish desire, right? That's what Buddhism teaches. So, you know, I don't have to if I'm upset about something if I'm grieving or if I'm you know, greedier, that's all my selfish desire. And I think that was really handy for the ruling classes over time. But that's only one very, very small facet of Buddhism, because Buddhism teaches so much that's amazing and wonderful. But yeah, they used it to their to build that society. And you're right. They didn't use it to extinguish the existing mythology, the existing Shinto culture. They kind of worked it all in together. The other religions that came through, you know, obviously Christianity doesn't fit with Shinto at all, and it doesn't fit with Buddhism, but not in the way that they practice. But I think the failure of Christianity to take hold in Japan, and you know, there's plenty of Japanese Christians now, but that a lot of that was political and, you know, enforced, right? There were the during the Sengoku Jidai, the warlord age, like the Shogun, if you watch Shogun, like around that time, there were Christian warlords, daimyo, and there were non-Christian ones. And, you know, the Christianity was seen as a major threat to the establishment of a unified Japan by the Tokugawa side. You know, so there's a lot of that going on. It's a fascinating history, and a sad one as well. And, you know, but remember the times, you know, hundreds of years ago, centuries ago, people just did horrible things to one another all over the place. So yeah, it was, you know.
Confucianism did have a foothold at one point, but did really, Confucius ideas is more of a culture than a religion. So there you go again, that, you know, it didn't really take hold much because of the fact that it's very simple. Now, with that being said, a simulation of culture is definitely there. And they were embodied what is there, put it around it, shape it to their whim at, you know, at any given moment. What is it like to maybe go to a different region that has different customs than when you said before?
It's part of the beauty of Japan. Like, you know, if you go to Japan and all you do is sit around Tokyo and the Kanto area, which is the area surrounding Tokyo, you're going to get, you know, very similar experiences. But, you know, Japan's about basically the size of California, maybe a little larger. And each of the regions And even in some cases, every single small town has its own, like, unique flavor. Sometimes even languages are different. I mean, it's all Japanese, but there's dialects, yeah, you know. The main differences are probably around food. By this time, where the country's really been mixed and centralized and everything, but still, food differences. There's some attitude differences between the East and the West, between the Osaka culture versus the Tokyo culture. You know, it's kind of like New York, Chicago type of a situation. Osaka's funnier, grittier, food's better. The local food is better. Tokyo is a lot more buttoned up, but the wealthier, and the international food scene is outrageously great, you know. But you really want to get a great flavor for Japan, just, you know, get yourself a festival calendar and just go around the country when you can to different festivals, different seasons. You know, in the town where I lived for the first 3 years, the town's called Owase. And Owase is in a place called Mie Prefecture. And if you look at Japan, it's kind of shaped like a boomerang. And, you know, the kind of southernmost part of the boomerang on the main island is kind of where I was. And every February, our town had our big yearly festival. And it was called the Yaya Matsuri, the Yaya Festival. And the entire town, there's only 20,000, 25,000 people in the town. The town would they'd board up the windows. Like, they'd kind of set up these barriers around the streets. I was like, what's going on here? They're like, oh, you'll see. And then the men of different sections of the town get these, like, happy coats. It's called a happy. These are little coats with their little sigil on the back. And then they drink and then roam around town. And when you encounter a group of men from another part of the town, you basically have this, like, almost like rugby style rush against them. And it's supposed to be a friendly shoving match, but it always ends up being, okay, who's going to beat the hell out of the other guys? But it is like seen in a very positive, friendly way, but people get bruised up and beat up. And they do this for days until one of the groups becomes like the main, this part of town wins. Then, after it's all over, they all jump into the harbor, naked. It's like it's February, so it's freezing cold. So they jump into the harbor naked to cleanse themselves of the festival and of the year, and they come out. Everybody's just friendly and love. It's wonderful. It's love fest. It's fantastic. If anybody's seen Blue-Eyed Samurai, you know, like I don't know if you've seen Blue-Eyed Samurai. It's I've seen it now four times. That scene where they're in this village and everybody they have to jump into the lake naked so that they and retrieve the magic stick or something that's going to guarantee them luck for the coming year. That's kind of what it was like in where I lived. People would just jump into the harbor naked, that's one example of like a culture that doesn't really there's no other place in Japan that has like that exact same type of a festival. But there are these big festivals where it's like a competition between usually the men, although I think now women are allowed more, and it ends up being with the goal of deciding who the lucky guys are for the coming year, or who is going to rule the roost or something. There was this festival not too far from where I lived in Wakayama Prefecture called the Shingu Fire Festival. Shingu is a very famous old historical town. Shingu means shrine, new shrine. And there's a massive shrine system there, the Kumano shrines. But they have this mountain. It's a small mountain, but they have a mountain. It also happens to be one of the two centers for Aikido, Aikijutsu. Right? So like at the time I lived there, the oldest living master of Aikido was living in Shingu. And there would be people there training. So they had this festival called the Fire Festival. You put on these like straw slippers, right? Warabi, I think. Warabi or waraji? Waraji, right? You put on these straw kind of slippers and you put on a white thing and they give you a torch, like a lit torch, and you run up this mountain. And you run up the mountain, and the person who gets there to the top and back, I don't know, I forget how it goes, they're the person of the year. But you can imagine that with all of these people studying Aikido and it being, Shingu was like a direct kind of, there was a train coming from Osaka. So there was like a lots of ruffians and like thugs would show up for these festivals, right? Festival times are can be dicey. This fire festival would just be like people running up the mountain, smacking each other with the torches, you know, like turning into like a brawl. And it's dangerous because there's fire involved, you know? But these Aikido guys would just be up, you know, running up the mountain, just get out of my way, get out of my way. You know, so you always had these really interesting, interesting results from these kinds of festivals. I don't know where it's going. You were talking about the cultures in different places. It's just like that. There's something everywhere. Again, it comes down to food, the festivals, and in some cases, the language, you know, but the people are wonderful everywhere.
It's the regional dynamics. Japanese, go to each town, go to each prefecture, different parts of, you know, the areas, and you really will have different religion customs, regional based, and even different practices. That's kind of what has been the main focus and so many of the small towns to drive the tourism being part of it as well. But sometimes these towns can't support without the tourism, and the tourism, you know, they have to reevaluate what to do. So some of the smaller regional areas that don't have a lot of tourism that depend heavily on it are going to be affected if there's not a lot of people going to these areas. So it's more important, I would say, have a blend of mainstream and small areas. That way you can benefit both. Because a small town really do try to cater to the tourism that get to come in with attractions, with, you know, springs, with different things to really the festivals being a driving force to go to these areas that normally wouldn't go. It's important to promote, you know, their own culture, their stuff, their ideas. And they want other people to be a part of that.
Yep.
And with that being said, it's very important to have that feeling. Because they might disappear. Some of these towns might not be around if they are not financially.
They merge together. They do what they can to survive, you know, and there's not a lot. There's a population decline right now in Japan. They're trying to encourage people to move back away from the cities, back to their hometowns. It's not working very well. Yeah, so they rely on you know, some of it they rely on government subsidy. Some of it they rely on tourism. I just thought of this now. Maybe you could just think of it and like they need three things. They need food, festivals, and flowers. Right. If you think of those three things, then you can understand Japan's tourism situation. Food, of course, people will go to different regions, different places. You have to go to Owase to get the best, you know, their thing was something called samma. It's like a mackerel, right? You want the best samma in Japan, you go to Owase. You want the best, you know, name a fish, go to this town. You want the best fruit, you want the best mikan, or, you know, the best mangoes, you got to go to Kyushu, that kind of thing. And these towns get these reputation for the food. The festivals we talked about. Flowers, right? Japanese are severely and intensely tuned in to nature. And, you know, particularly the cherry blossoms, right? You follow the cherry blossom route and you're going to follow, you know, this kind of interesting tourism / cultural wave. You know, my very favorite thing year after year in Japan is hanami, the cherry blossom viewing time. And it is literally my favorite thing to do in the entire world, is to sit down under the cherry tree with your friends, drinking beer, having great food, listening to music, whatever it is. Just that is all you do. And just watch the cherry trees kind of bloom, I suppose. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that when you travel around Japan or you go and, you know, if you get there, you time it right with the cherry blossom festivals. I mean, you know, you're really seeing a cultural driver. You know, different places in Japan are famous for gardens, for special gardens. There's these royal gardens in Kanazawa you got to go to, or in wherever. So watch the food, the festivals, and the flowers, and you can get yourself a really good tour of Japan.
I'm actually able to go to a trip. I'm actually going on a cruise. So I'm already going with my coworker. We're all going together. And I'm going to hit up different spots. 14 actual spots. Tokyo, Nagawa, Shizumu, Beppu. Kaito. I'm also going to Fuji. Shizumu, I think. Shizumu? Yeah, Shizumu. And I'm going to do, and then also Seoul, North and South Korea.
Yeah.
Duto. So I'm going to be able to disembark. Well, I'm going on to Tokyo, and then I'll disembark in Seoul, and then flying back. So with mine, I have access to Mount Fuji. I'm probably going to do Osaka Castle as one of the excursions, because that's going to be in the area. Mount Fuji will be big. Hitting up one of the shrines, one of the bigger shrines they have. And then also, there's also springs as well.
What time of year are you going?
I'm going May 4th through May 14th.
It's a beautiful time in Japan. It's probably the best. You'll probably miss the cherry blossoms, but and Mount Fuji will. But Mount Fuji should still have snow on it. So you should be able to see a nice Fuji. Weather's great. Great time. Weather's wonderful. So that is the best time to go to the cities, because if it's summertime, it's too hot. Castles are great. They're like everything you've seen in Shogun or in anime. It's like that's exactly what they're like. You know, with the Nightingale floors.
Like new older castle, and then you have a new development of business. So you have like that new Dohon sector in one of the towns, and then I also have the opportunity, because there's only 6 destinations that have pretty much, you know, 21 excursions. The other ones are just going to be going in and probably just taking a look around. I mean, just walk for the day. So
yeah. Well, it sounds like a wonderful, fun opportunity. And, you know, I absolutely encourage you and anybody who goes on these kinds of trips, you know, try to get into town, you know, get off the beaten path a little bit, find a really great place to eat. You know, if you're in Tokyo, I'm sure that you're going to do some of the touristy things, but, you know, if you can get to the fish market,
I'm going to be flying on the 2nd. Yeah. I want to get there. If I'm flying on the 2nd, I'll probably be getting there on the 3rd.
Yep.
And Japan's equivalent time zone, because it's going to be 14 hours difference.
That's right.
They're ahead of us. So I had to fly, you know, in preparation for the 3rd, get ready for the 4th. And then when I'm flying back, it would be the 14th in Japan's time, but it would be the 13th over here.
Yeah.
So I actually take off 9 days instead. So
yeah, it's a good plan.
Have like 24 hours of time to get back. Mm-hmm. Have plenty of rest, so I'm not worried about the next day going back to work, because that's fine by me.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. It is, you know, I miss Japan terribly. I was there, it's been almost a year since I've been back. So I was there last January, and I plan to go sometime in the coming year, as soon as I can, you know, see my daughter, check, see some friends. I still have a lot of friends there. I miss it terribly. And if you or any of your listeners have any questions about, you know, stuff to do in Japan, things to see, you know, I might not be up to date on where the newest clubs are or the best restaurants, the best new restaurants. But I definitely love the place and would love to go back again soon.
In Tokyo, I might spend the night. I might do a net cafe. Or a capsule.
It's kind of so. It's fun.
My other friends, you should do like the manga. It's like, oh, well, I could. I was thinking maybe just have like access to a little room with the net cafe. So it just depends.
Yeah.
But with that, that wraps up Living in Japan 101. Dan, thank you for being here. It was a great pleasure having you. We really did dive into different regional differences. Marriage, view about, you know, different things that, you know, might be atypical for foreigner in Japan. Thank you for being here. It was nice having this conversation. Where can they find you?
Yeah.
And all that.
Yeah, Mason, thank you so much for having me on. And you know, I am glad that I was able to talk about some of these things. I wish we we have more time, we talk about maybe getting into a little bit of my recent ventures into anime and some other entertainment side stuff. But we'll save that for another time. But if you want to find me, just go to b-inquisitive.com or check me out on LinkedIn, Dan Nessel, and on all the socials at DS Nessel. Or, you know, I should mention, if any of you are out there are interested in public relations and communications and hearing some of the best experts in that field, you have to tune into my podcast called The Trending Communicator, and just look for me or The Trending Communicator where we get podcasts, and you will see conversational show. So I highly encourage you to check it out if that's where your interests are.
All right. Thank you for being here. It was nice having you.
My pleasure, Mason.
This concludes another episode of MC Anime Podcast. MC Anime Podcast is available on podcast directories like Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and YouTube. We also have our website at mcanimepodcast.com. If you want to directly support us, then follow Patreon blog MC Anime. Finally, if you want services for hire, then we're available on Fiverr for audio and video production, graphic design, idea consulting, and blog and article writing.